This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Hampden County Sheriff Nick Cochi says that 79 prisoners and 20 staff members have tested positive for the coronavirus at the county jail in Ludlow. This comes amidst allegations by attorneys for two prisoners that the State Department of Correction is trying to hide the number of people dying of COVID-19 in its custody. WBUR senior correspondent Deborah Becker has been reporting on how Massachusetts correctional facilities are handling the coronavirus pandemic, and she joins us now. Deb, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So, really, Deb, I was taken aback by the numbers at Hampden County, but this actually isn't a one-off situation. Can you give us kind of a rundown of coronavirus infections in state correctional facilities?
Right. Well, as the virus has increased throughout Massachusetts, it has also spiked in jails and prisons. Starting at about the end of October, several correctional facilities have reported outbreaks. The Essex County Jail, the Massachusetts Alcohol and Substance Abuse Facility in Plymouth actually stopped accepting admissions for those who are civilly committed to addiction treatment because of an outbreak there. MCI Norfolk had a very large outbreak. And most recently, as you mentioned, the Hampden County Jail and MCI Shirley. MCI Shirley right now has the highest number of infected prisoners, 167 men there testing positive as of yesterday. There are 13 prisoners hospitalized in local hospitals with COVID-19. And since the pandemic began, 8 men in state prisons have died from COVID-19 and 2 men in county jails.
So what are officials saying they're going to do to reduce the spread, or what are they doing?
Well, both the jails and the sheriffs who oversee the jails and the prisons and the State Department of Correction, which oversees the prisons, say they've been taking several steps. They've banned visitors, they've increased cleaning, and they're doing more testing. The DOC says it's done more than 16,000 tests across all of its prisons. It says that it does comprehensive mobile testing and day-to-day testing of anyone who is symptomatic. After the Hampden County outbreak yesterday, the sheriff said that staff members who are positive are at home quarantining. All positive cases of prisoners are showing no symptoms or mild symptoms, and he says they're receiving around-the-clock medical care and medical quarantine. And he also said that any new admissions to the Hampden County Jail are quarantined for 14 days before they're allowed to go into the general population. Various steps that they say they've been taking really since the pandemic began to try to mitigate this.
So you just talked about quarantining. I have trouble imagining that prisons and jails have a lot of excess space for social distancing, keeping inmates separate.
That's right. Many of the prisoners, as you can imagine, are sharing very small cells. Some prisoners are in dormitory units with dozens of other prisoners. And these medical quarantine units are different depending on the facility. We've heard from several prisoners. We've communicated with them, and they say that there is a real risk. But these quarantine facilities themselves tend to be large rooms where many men go, in some cases, to be monitored for symptoms. In other cases, men are put in single cells, almost what some prisoners say, almost like solitary confinement, to try to keep them away from the rest of the population and keep the virus from spreading.
You have been reporting on a story about two Massachusetts prisoners who were granted medical parole only after they were hospitalized with COVID-19. They died shortly after, and that means their deaths may not be included in the state's reporting of COVID-19 prisoner deaths. I wonder, do prisoner advocates trust the testing and tracking data that's coming from the Department of Correction?
Well, there are a lot of questions, I guess. These two prisoners that you mentioned had been denied medical parole, and yet when they were very ill and hospitalized, medical parole was granted. And in both cases, that happened one day before these men died. One man was incarcerated at MCI Shirley, and his attorney is Ruth Greenberg, and this is what she said.
My client was released between 6 and 8 hours before his death. It appears that was so that his death could not be counted as an inmate death at Shirley.
Now, the DOC says that it is trying to reduce the prison population and trying to deal with the spread of the virus throughout correctional facilities. And it says it's taken, among the precautionary measures it's taken, is the use of medical parole for prisoners who are eligible under state law. And I think that's the key there, because the state medical parole law allows for prisoners to be paroled only if they're terminally ill and incapacitated. So COVID alone is not a reason to get medical parole, even if someone has underlying health issues. So legally, the Department of Correction is probably within its legal rights to not grant medical parole unless someone is already incapacitated. But the attorneys point out the medical parole law wasn't necessarily written with a pandemic in mind.
Well, with the numbers that you've given us, it sounds like the situation with the virus in state correctional facilities really is dire. So what are political leaders, I'm talking the governor, the legislature, doing about it?
Right. Well, this has been discussed by various lawmakers on Beacon Hill. It's the subject of a lot of litigation. Most of the efforts to deal with the virus behind bars have come about because of litigation. There was a recent agreement reached with the Correction Officers Union where the DOC said all correction officers would have to be tested. That wasn't mandated until about 6 weeks ago. So there are a lot of questions. There's a lot of litigation moving forward about, are there other ways to deal with this? Should it be monitored legally? Should there be an independent person overseeing the Department of Correction and its efforts to try to deal with the virus? And I spoke with Katie Naples Mitchell, who's a legal scholar at Harvard Law School, and she feels that the state should be doing more. This is what she said.
The fact that these outbreaks are happening was avoidable had there been regular surveillance testing of staff, which are the primary vectors of bringing an infection into a largely closed environment where especially visitation had been prevented for many months. So the idea that there wasn't testing happening on a regular basis and that it took 8 months for the DOC to get the union to negotiate on that is really disappointing.
And so that's what Katie Naples Mitchell says, primarily about the agreement to try to get testing among staff members at the Department of Correction. And there are others who are calling on the state to do more. The SJC asked Governor Baker to use his clemency powers to try to reduce the number of people incarcerated and to either pardon or commute sentences so people could be released. So perhaps social distancing could improve in correctional facilities. So far, there has been one clemency hearing by the parole board, actually one in Governor Baker's entire time in office.
All right. That is WBUR's Deborah Becker. Deb, thanks.
You're welcome.
It is official. The Boston Foundation has announced that Lee Pelton, who is now the president of Emerson College, will step down from that role in June to take over as the foundation's next president and CEO. The Boston Foundation is one of the 20 largest community foundations in the country, and it has assets of more than $1.2 billion. Here to talk with us about it is Lee Pelton. President Pelton, welcome back to the show.
Well, good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Appreciate you joining us. I want to congratulate you on your appointment, and I want to ask, you have described this opportunity as a calling, and you've said you've been training for it for many years. Tell us what that means.
Well, it means that civic leadership and giving back to the communities in which I live, using my resources and talents, it defines who I am. What I hope to be, and I have been doing this for as long as I can remember, and I have used my the platform of the presidencies at Emerson and at my previous institution, and even as the dean at Dartmouth and other places, as a way for me to speak out on important issues to be civically engaged myself, and also to remind my students that they have an obligation to be engaged in the civic life of their community and their nation and the world.
You said that, you know, giving back defines who you are. You will have an opportunity to help do that on a massive capacity with the Boston Foundation. That is a billion-dollar organization. I think it's safe to say that with, you know, their assets, their power, the Boston Foundation can create a center of gravity around an issue. Arguably, Paul Grogan, your predecessor, did that with a sustained focus on charter schools, for example, for a number of years.
Right.
Where do you want to create a center or centers of gravity with the foundation's resources?
Well, it's too early for me to say what those centers of gravity might be. But I am happy to say today that we will be looking through our grant making, at least through the permanent fund of our grant making, through the lens of doing our very best to break down the structural and systemic barriers and inequities that have prevented many of our in our community from having full access and participation in American democracy.
You wrote an essay this summer, President Pelton, for the Emerson community called America is on Fire in response to the protests over Minneapolis police killing George Floyd, or really over in response to the act of killing George Floyd. It was personal. How will your experience as a Black man and a Black man who was educated at Harvard and has run institutions like Emerson guide the way you're going to approach leadership at the foundation, grant making at the foundation?
Well, you know, I wrote that, you know, that essay, which got between 7 and 8 million views around the world, to do two things. One was to make the invisible visible. That is to say, to make George Floyd's murder visible. And it was his invisibility, and it was the officer's sense that he was not human that allowed him to put his knee on his neck for almost 9 minutes until he cried out for his mama and said, "I cannot breathe." And it was there in plain sight for all of us to see. And so what we learned from that event is that as awful as that event was, it was not new. And it's very much in the fabric of our American society. And I wanted to suggest in a particular kind of way that I'm George Floyd, too. That I've experienced or I've had experiences which are dehumanizing and in which I am believed to be invisible. The other thing that I wanted to show or provide is for Black and brown leaders in this city and beyond to speak up about their own encounters with racism. And their own encounters with experiences that are dehumanizing. And I think I was able to do both of those. Storytelling is powerful. It can be transformative. And I think it's important for me and for others to tell our stories in support of our various causes.
Is there a way you have in mind that the foundation could advance and support community storytelling like that?
Well, I think what we will do is we will reach out to communities. We will be in communities. We will listen intently and actively and be in partnership with those communities and those neighborhoods as we seek to make Boston a better place to live for all of its citizens.
When you say be in communities, tell me more about what that means. Will you require program officers to spend time inside community organizations? Are you going to hold your meetings in different places so that you're more physically present? What do you mean when you say we're going to be in communities?
Well, it means that we'll be physically present in these communities. And I will be very visible and present in these communities. You know, one of the great aspects of the Boston Foundation has been its ability to partner and collaborate. And we do want to partner and collaborate with nonprofits, with the government, and with private corporations, and so on. But we also want to do that with authenticity. with honesty and sincerity in Boston neighborhoods. So I will be very visible in those neighborhoods, listening and learning as a way to shape our agenda for the future.
I want to ask you a little bit of a challenging question here. Part of the foundation's financial growth over the years has been through donor-advised funds. They're ubiquitous in philanthropy. I know you know they're not without controversy. You know, donors get the full tax benefit of a charitable contribution, but in practice, they often maintain quite a bit of personal control over timing and direction of the money. You probably also know that the you know, the philanthropic field itself is asking whether using funds that way, many of the philanthropic approaches that are common now can break the status quo, break systemic inequality, for example, or racism, when the assets remain under the control of those who have prospered from that status quo. Do you see that as a challenge, and how are you thinking about that?
Well, we will continue to work with these donors to increase the impact of their philanthropy. And I am both hopeful and convinced that we will be able to produce good outcomes, as we already have in the past.
Are there different kinds of impacts or outcomes that you're hopeful to have the foundation embrace than perhaps it has in the past? I mean, we are in a moment, and this moment is different than where we were 2 years ago, 3 years ago even.
Yeah, well, we are in a moment, and as I said, we given all of the issues and opportunities that we and other foundations have to have to have an impact on the communities, neighborhoods, and the broader society, the moment requires that we look through. We look through everything that we do through the lens of inequity and systemic and structural barriers that prevent, as I said earlier, citizens from fully participating in society. And so that will be the lens for now, but we also understand that these issues are intersectional. They intersect with lots of other issues, gender issues, LGBTQ issues, economic issues, and so on.
Last question for you. Boston Foundation is a proud and venerable institution in our community. What are you most proud of about taking the role next as president and CEO?
Well, there are, it's a tripartite role. One is a grant making, supporting nonprofits throughout the region. And we want to be engaged in funding equity and equity funding. We want to continue to partner with our donors and work with them to increase the impact of their philanthropy on the variety of issues that you and I have just discussed. And we want to continue to be a civic leader. And we've done that in the past, and we'll continue to do that in the future as a convener, a partner, a collaborator, and with our research resources. So that we can shine a bright light on the key issues that face our communities.
Well, that is Emerson College President Lee Pelton, who will be taking over as the next president and CEO of the Boston Foundation at the end of the academic year in June. President Pelton, thank you so much for your time, and we hope to talk with you again on the show soon.
Thank you very much.
So Boston's temporary outdoor dining program is no more. As of yesterday, restaurants in the city can no longer use public sidewalks and parking lanes for outdoor dining. So with that option largely gone and winter weather nearly upon us, it means that restaurants are, again, they're going to grapple with how to survive this pandemic. And we want to ask you, we want to invite you to be part of this conversation. Are you still dining outside in your community? Can you or would you? And what else are you doing to support your local restaurants, the ones you like the best? And you can feel free to give those a shout out with us. Also, as the weather gets colder, outdoor dining goes away, you're going to do more takeout? Are you going to think about indoor dining? Call us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. So we have been checking in with Nia Grace and Bob Luz since the start of the pandemic, and they both join us again now. Nia Grace is proprietor and general manager of Daryl's Corner Bar and Kitchen in Boston. And Bob Luz is the president and CEO of the Massachusetts Restaurant Association. I want to welcome you both back. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Nia, I'm going to start with you. I want to ask you, how's it been since we last checked in over the summer? How's business been?
Well, you know, it's been a series of ups and downs. We had a lot of excitement, I would say, during the summer and the early fall where we did have outdoor dining. We had some on-site space that was already private for us, but then we also utilized the city's in outdoor dining program. And we saw a lot of great, like I said, excitement and success from that. And it was definitely needed. So,
how much of your capacity do you lose now, Nia, with the public spaces that you could use for seating gone?
Yeah, it brings us back down to a capacity of 30%. And it's just super tough right now, definitely.
So that is, it's going to make it challenging for you over the winter.
It is. It's something that we immediately started to feel when the weather changed. The weather dropped, got below 40, even with heaters and other provisions. You could already see the change and feel the hurt. We've already had to start cutting staff, changing schedules, totally cutting back. And we see more of that happening soon.
Bob, are you hearing that from other restaurants as well? You know, this losing capacity as outdoor dining is restricted or eliminated and worried about making it through the winter?
Yeah, there's no question. I mean, restaurateurs are very creative, but you can only get so creative with restricted space. And so, you know, Boston has challenges because, you know, Mayor Walsh, first of all, was incredible and quickly rolling out and allowing this to happen into streets and sidewalks and really got behind it largely and moved, I think, 450 or so licenses very quickly. But, you know, there's unique situations in Boston, namely safety and snow removal that prohibits it during the winter months. And so, you know, it's going to be a big challenge for restaurateurs, and they're trying to figure it out day by day right now.
You know, Bob, before I go back to Nia, I've seen some articles with people kind of wondering how safe, as we protect outdoor dining from the elements as much as possible. You get sides on the tents, you get space heaters, maybe people are a little closer together. What about the safety of semi-enclosed outdoor spaces for dining during this pandemic?
First of all, we think both indoor and outdoor are very safe, and the way we believe that is the governor's own data, which is, you know, in the last several periods that they've reported, less than 2% of all cases traced back to a restaurant. And, you know, restaurants, you know, the ABCC has been inspecting them since mid-August. 97% of over 11,000 restaurant inspections have shown that the restaurants are in 100% compliance with all the COVID protocols the state put on them. So restaurants are operating very safely. They've invested a lot of money into making sure that they had solutions that protected their guests. And not one restaurateur, whether it's Nia Grace or anyone else, not one restaurateur would open up if they weren't 100% certain that their guests and employees were safe first and foremost. So people should feel very, very safe about coming into our restaurants. And when they do, they say, boy, it feels good. The protocols are being followed.
1-800-423-8255. We've got Driscoll on the line from Worcester. Driscoll, go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks. Very please good. Go ahead.
Fantastic. I was calling to say that my fiance and I have been extremely COVID precautious. We haven't actually dined out to eat in a restaurant since Valentine's Day all the way back in February. And since then we have, you know, gotten engaged, but not hugged any of our family members, kept our distance, our own isolation pods. Thankfully, our families have been COVID-free. But it just feels really risky to be sitting down and dining in a restaurant. So we've opted for the takeout, and we've been supporting our local restaurants pretty heavily, heavy tips, all that stuff. But we just can't bring ourselves to eat out in a restaurant.
Thanks for the call, Driscoll, and congratulations on the engagement. Nia, you've been listening here. Let me give you a chance as a restaurant owner and general manager. Let me give you a chance to respond to all that.
Yeah. You know, a second, Bob. Notes about restaurants haven't always been held to a higher standard in terms of our safety protocols. And I mean, I think we all know that, and I absolutely understand the response from all of our customers, the varied response from all of our customers, from those who feel comfortable dining in, from those who, you know, continue to show their support by ordering takeout. And as we continue to respond, we're doing the same thing. We're literally just responding to our customers' needs as well as our staff needs first and foremost. And we're trying to make the best decisions. And I think that we are doing what's best for all, for sure. And it just continues to be a challenge as we wait out the next phase. And so I totally appreciate Driscoll's comments. And, yeah, congratulations, too, on that. Yep.
Nia, when you say you're responding to your customers' needs, what does that look like? What's something that you're doing differently or that you've got set up differently now to be responsive to what your customers want?
You know, I think it started from the beginning, you know, the touchless menus, the spacing, the visual awareness of watching our new protocols or our heightened protocols, you know, being worked out or responding to the request of, you know, takeout and it being more than just that individual meal. You know, we've had to change entire menus as other restaurants have as well to satisfy the smaller families who would rather, you know, that kind of meal as opposed to just these individual dinners that we're used to, you know, dishing out, be it curbside or, you know, even the cocktails to go if that's what they want. We're just trying to be responsive. And I mean, truthfully, it's just a part of what's keeping us alive. By being responsive to our customers.
Bob, over the months, we have talked with you about the needs from local, state, and federal government of restaurateurs, you know, as small business owners in order to weather this pandemic, no pun intended, while we're talking about the winter, so that they'll be there for us on the other side. Now that outdoor dining is more restricted, as Nia said, it brings her back down to 30% capacity. What do you think restaurants need from state government, from federal government?
Well, there's no question what's desperately needed is, you know, look, the state government, the governor is constitutionally bound to make sure his budget is balanced. So the ability for the state government to really assist the industry that has been most devastated of all just is very, very slim. And they're doing things, and we're hoping that they get them done. So we are awaiting some help from the state. But absolutely the real answer has to come from the federal government. And you know, there's great disappointment and anger that, unfortunately, it's become a political quagmire in trying to get something done here. We were very confident it would be done before the conventions. It didn't happen. We thought it would happen before the election. It didn't happen. Now it looks like it'll be, you know, potentially after the first year. You know, the reality is Congress is going to leave next Friday. And our cry to them is, look, if you can't get an comprehensive plan done on stimulus, for, you know, to cover everything, at least carve out pieces that you can. A second round of PPP, absolutely. Unemployment insurance, you know, at reasonable amounts that help those in our industry that have been devastated. So we think they might have to break it off and do bits of it as opposed to a comprehensive package, but they have to do it, and they have to stop pointing fingers at each other.
Let's go to the phones, 800-423-8255. We've got Joe on the line from Sherburn. Joe, go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to say one good option is to use delivery services. So
in Sherbourne. We're in the suburbs, and previously some of these delivery services hadn't yet penetrated where I live. But now, since the pandemic hit, we use services such as DoorDash to help support our local restaurants and get convenient delivery.
Thanks for that, Joe. Nia, are you working with a delivery service like that?
Yes, we currently employ a few different delivery services like Uber Eats and Grubhub and even DoorDash. And, you know, something else to kind of further the point of the relief that we're looking for in terms of restaurants is capping third-party delivery fees. So while they are, you know, great tools to actually get our product to, you know, our customers and friends, and, you know, it's a great marketing resource, the cut that they take off at the top from a restaurant is really tough, where most of the time it's between 25 to 32% before you even get to see the first dollar from that sale. So in times like this, you know, we're looking there. There are other states who have done it. We would love to see some kind of cap support there in terms of those delivery fees. But yes, we are.
Bob, is that something that the Massachusetts Restaurant Association is working on? You know, is that
yes.
Is that a position of your organization? Tell us more.
Yes, it is. Actually, it is in legislation that we filed that is currently in the economic development bills for the Senate, and it's actually in a committee right now trying to come to an answer between the House and Senate versions of the economic development package. It would cap delivery fees until the end of the pandemic at 15%. And the reason being, and Nia pointed it out so well, look, you know, most places didn't have takeout or delivery before this, and we pivoted and really built these programs out from scratch. And so restaurants, delivery companies and full-service restaurants went from really very small sales to having significant sales, but they've kept their fees the same. And so what we're asking them to do is cap their fees till we get through this. And to me, it only makes sense because the only way they're going to have customers on the other end of this is if they help the restaurants get through it. And so that is, we're awaiting that in the Economic Development Committee, you know, report out hopefully very soon.
So, Nia, we are all tracking the development and distribution possibilities of a vaccine with bated breath. And Governor Baker has said the average citizen sometime next spring may have access to the vaccine. To get to then, to the point where it becomes post-pandemic, if we can even use that phrase, what has to happen for you for Daryl's Corner to stay alive until that point?
You know, I don't know how many more ways to get creative, but I think that you know, is one of those key points for us. You know, we are an economy where our business is based off of, you know, our food, our cocktail sales, but a third heavy component is our live music and entertainment. That just happens to be a part of our economy. So the gig workers that work for us are not employed right now too, right? So you're talking about how do we get back to 100%? How do we maintain them to that part? It's how do I get them employed as well? You know, to me, it's do I have to consider this half phase of hibernation? A lot of restaurants are doing it. Some had already gone into it, you know, as soon as the fall hit. We now need to consider it because, you know, to your point and to others' point, you know, people don't necessarily want to go inside until that point. You know, flu season is here, and more people are scared and more vulnerable at this point, too. And so what is it going to take for us to get to the spring? It's going to take more takeout. It's going to take more virtual events. It's going to actually take some relief, though, too, for our workers, because I imagine that we're going to have to move into another phase of furlough and layoffs.
Yeah. That is Nia Grace, proprietor and general manager of Daryl's Corner Bar and Kitchen, and Bob Luz of the Massachusetts Restaurant Association. Thanks for checking in again to both of you today. We'll be thinking about you.
Thank you. And thanks for everybody for frequenting our restaurants. We appreciate it.
You're listening to the best-selling band on the planet right now, the K-pop group BTS. Here, they're performing Life Goes On to an empty Microsoft Theater at last week's American Music Awards. BTS took home 2 awards, Best Duo or Group, and Best Pop, Rock, and Social Artist, acknowledging their ability to affect change in the world through engagement with their fans. The success of BTS and other K-pop groups like Blackpink, BoA, G-Dragon is part of the Korean Wave, or Hanyu, which refers to the global growth of Korean pop culture since the 1990s.
K-pop, I would say, is a style and culture of pop music born of a particular system of management in contemporary South Korea. So it is quite simply popular music that comes from Korea. Currently, today in the West, it denotes a particular type of content, a sound, and approach.
That's Haeju Kim, the new assistant chair of the professional music department at the Berklee School of Music, and an expert on K-pop and popular music in Korea. Now that K-pop is dominating in America, Kim says there are lessons in its success for American music students. She also says it is a great time to be Korean. When we talked with her, we started by asking her why.
Yeah, so when I was growing up in the States in the 70s and 80s, people didn't really know what Korea was. And I would often get asked, are you Chinese or Japanese? And those were the only sort of 2 options. Thinking back to American popular media, the only references to Korean culture was probably the TV show MASH. And so, you know, the Korean Americans had to go to the local Korean grocery to rent videotapes if they wanted to watch Korean programming. And so to sort of not be known as a country, and then to kind of be in this moment where Korean popular culture is, you know, it's really hot, has been just a fascinating moment to watch as a Korean American.
And just for our listeners' sake, those who may not know MASH, it was a television show about a mobile army hospital during the Korean War. So what do you love about K-pop, and what drew you to want to research it? I mean, to really look at it from your professional perspective.
My initial entry into the Korean popular culture domain was through the Korean TV dramas, and I was very interested in the music soundtracks. And there was, over time, I guess starting in the 90s, it became clear to me that there were non-Korean audiences watching these Korean shows because they were coming out with subtitles. And so when I started to meet some of these non-Korean audiences, they would talk about Korean dramas in such a way that, you know, it was just so intense and they were so engaged. And a lot of that I found out had to do with the music. And it's just really interesting to see this world of pop culture that really engages the audience in ways that you don't necessarily see in the American pop culture menus, I guess.
So let's dive into that a little bit. The first K-pop group to chart in the U.S. was back in 2009, but it kind of feels like the first big Korean pop star to penetrate our cultural psyche or our cultural consciousness in the U.S. might have been Psy with his hit Gangnam Style. Let's listen.
Oppan Gangnam Style. Gangnam Style.
So is Psy the first big U.S. K-pop star, or is there a difference between Korean pop music like his and K-pop?
I think that Psy is both K-pop and is not K-pop. And what I mean by that is he is K-pop in the sense that, you know, he's a Korean pop musician. And he also has characteristics that we have come to associate with K-pop. That is to say that it's very visual and it's very colorful. He also has a signature dance move. You know, it was that dance move that caught everyone's imagination. It was that horsey move with the one wrist over the other. And so in those ways, I think he is broadly K-pop. But he's also not the kind of K-pop that we've come to associate with the idol culture.
So, Haeju, you use this word idol, and my guess is mm-hmm. for people who are not familiar with K-pop, they do not understand. Mm-hmm. When you say idol, You mean like Beatles on the Rooftop level of idol? You know, I'm talking, thinking about the K-pop band BTS. It's one of the biggest acts in the U.S. right now. It is a 7-member boy band who released their 4th album, Map of the Soul 7, this year. And BTS member RM, who was the primary English speaker for them, was asked on Good Morning America in February why he thinks BTS has taken off in the U.S. and has this kind of idol status here. Here he is.
They're so cute and attractive. But, you know, the most important thing is that, you know, music truly transcends the language and nationalities and races, right?
Okay, so to put it in perspective, BTS, Forbes' Celebrity 100 in 2019 had them ranked at number 43, earning $57 million in pre-tax income last year. Is that because of what he's saying, this popularity? Is it really that simple and driving those kinds of numbers?
Yeah, so the type of idols that BTS are, they are very outward looking. They're focused on a global market. And the type of music that they're bringing brings many avenues of engagement and participation, the music and the dance and the kinds of stories they're telling through the music videos. And so I tend to think of K-pop as a culture that really invites participation from the audience. And I think that's one of the reasons that it's become, you know, so globally popular, and the fandoms are really intense. So it's this kind of invitation that's really been a draw.
I want to play a little bit of one of BTS's songs. This one is called Boy With Love and features U.S. artist Halsey. So you write about K-pop music having elements of these Euro-American styles. They're filtered, reworked in a new Korean context, but it isn't just Western music styles being brought back to us or sold back to us. You also talked about the way that fans have embraced groups like BTS online, the social media dimension, and the deep, almost sense of ownership of these K-pop groups. And I thought that was really interesting when we started to see the spillover into political activism. Okay, so all of a sudden I'm hearing about K-pop, right, in the context of President Donald Trump's rally in Tulsa. And I thought that was a joke at first, but it wasn't. Fans reserved the tickets to make it look like more people were going to come and to keep the seats empty. And BTS fans matched the band's $1 million donation to Black Lives Matter groups. That's serious political activism. Should that be surprising?
It's not surprising to me because the K-pop or BTS fandom, you know, we're talking about digital natives here. They're very, very savvy. They're very sophisticated on social media. And you combine that with everything that BTS stands for, and their message is all about, you know, loving yourself, embracing your identity, speaking yourself. And then we kind of had this moment where everyone was stuck at home during COVID. And so this was kind of resonating with people of color and, you know, minorities who really wanted to use that platform to support that message and get that out there. And so when BTS donated $1 million to BLM, within a day, the ARMY, which is the fandom name for BTS, the ARMY, they matched that dollar for dollar.
So that's one aspect of the phenomenon to discuss, but there is another one, and a challenging one. The genre has received criticism for exploitation. These are young artists. They have grueling routines and diets. The industry has control over the stars' personal lives. Last fall, 2 K-pop stars died from suicide within 2 months of each other, which kickstarted a conversation about this dark side of the industry. How do you square that part with the culture of joy that the music's always also known for and that you've cited in the music?
Yeah, so those deaths were really you know, they're shocking and they're tragic. I think that, you know, one of the reasons that BTS is so popular is because they do talk about social issues. They do talk about things like mental health and the anxieties, you know, of being youth and, you know, social pressures. So I think that BTS has really used their platform in music to talk about those things and address those issues. I will say also that, you know, while those things are tragic, I think that, you know, sort of that exploitation and the pressure, they, you know, these are things that also exist in other popular culture, you know, systems too. They do tend to get sort of emphasized in some way when there are discussions about Korean pop music. But I think that BTS is a good example of, as I said, you know, them taking that kind of sort of darker, sort of the shadows that exist and, you know, making the conversation a little bit brighter. I know every life's a movie. We got different stars and stories. We got different nights and mornings. Our scenarios ain't just boring. 나는 이 영화가 너무 재밌어.
So they are front and center right now. They have a big number one song called Dynamite. It kind of broke YouTube records with the music video topping 100 million views in the first 24 hours. Let's hear a little bit of that. So, fully sung in English for the first time. Why make that switch when BTS was doing so incredibly well globally without making that switch?
BTS did not go into the creation of this song. They didn't have to write something in English because, you know, they rose to global popularity with songs in Korean, and that was such a phenomenon. But, you know, the way that this song was created is that, you know, it came on their demo and it worked well in English, and they just sort of at one point in the process decided that it worked. So they tweaked the English lyrics a little bit and decided that, you know, it sounded good just the way it was.
So. If it works, it works, right?
Yeah, it works.
So last question for you, Haeju. What will you teach your Berkeley students about K-pop? And what are you going to focus on in your research while you're at Berkeley?
Yeah, so at Berkeley, we're excited to have more courses on sort of the history of K-pop from not just the 90s, but from the, you know, post-Korean War and how American popular music really made its mark on the Korean cultural landscape. While we do that, we want to take a look at a K-pop approach to popular music songs, because that approach and that model is a little bit different from the American approach, and to see how K-pop has succeeded in reaching audiences in such an effective way.
That's Haeju Kim. She's the new assistant chair of Berkeley's professional music department, and her research focuses on popular music in Korea, or K-pop. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It was great to be with you.
And that is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Withman. Our engineer today is Marquise Neal. Executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.